Hi everybody, Oisin here from the Troubles podcast. I'm currently in the planning stages for season 3 and have already started writing some episodes. But as a mid-season bonus, I wanted to release the full interview with Richard Moore. The Richard Moore episode, which was called Children of the Troubles, received a lot of positive feedback and comments, but the full interview with Richard is a good bit longer than what made it into the episode. This interview is a lot less polished than regular episodes and is virtually unedited. I released this to my Patreons 2 months ago and would now like to release it here. Before we get into it, if you've been enjoying this podcast and want to support it, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. There you can have access to a number of different features, including a private RSS feed, meaning you can enjoy the entire podcast ad-free in your own podcast app. There are also companion videos and a lot of media from The Troubles as well. All the money made from the Patreon will go back into the podcast and will also allow me more time to research and write episodes, so your support is greatly appreciated. Thanks again, now let's get into the interview. Let's keep it very simple, Richard. Do you want to tell me a little bit about yourself and maybe a bit about your early life?
Hi, well, I'm a man of 59 years of age now. I was born 1961 and I'm from Derry. And I grew up on a place called the Craigan Estate in Derry. And back in the 60s, the Craigan was a very nice and pleasant place to live for a young boy. My parents were basically unemployed. My father was an unemployed shoemaker. My mother was what you would describe nowadays as a homemaker. And there was 12 children in the house, 9 boys and 3 girls. So, you know, she was kept busy making a home and that. And but at a very warm, loving, friendly home and really never wanted for anything. But Craigan around 68, 69 was at the epicenter of the Northern Ireland conflict, really. And, you know, anybody that's not from Derry or maybe isn't familiar with Derry, Derry is separated by the River Foy. And the River Foy goes through the center of the city. So we have what they call the East Bank and the West Bank. And the West Bank was the side of the river that I lived on. And, you know, that part of Derry is surrounded by the border to the Irish Republic. So it starts at one side of the river, surrounds the town, and then goes around to the other side of the river. And, you know, the Craigan is up on a hill, sloping down towards the river. So you can come down from the Craigan, you reach the bog side. And then when you pass the bog side, you basically go into the city centre. And then you have the river there and all that. So Craigan on the bog side, really around 1968-69, became like a war zone. What I felt like it was an overnight change. You know, one day you're out playing football with your friends and, you know, and doing all the normal things that children do. And the next thing, you know, you're seeing the men of the neighborhood driving hijacked vehicles, ripping up the pavements, setting vehicles on fire, and then riots and bombings become a daily occurrence. Now, I'm sure it didn't happen overnight, but looking back on it, to me, it feels like it happened overnight.
Oh, absolutely. Like I'd imagine it's, and then it became such an integral part of your childhood, I guess, in a way, because it's literally right at your door.
Sorry, you cut out there.
Oh, sorry. If you wouldn't mind. No, but I'd imagine it became an integral part of your childhood because it's literally right outside your door. Like, do you remember the arrival of the British soldiers then?
Oh, aye. And, you know, like, the Craigan was a big estate. You know, it was a typical inner city sort of estate. You know, 15,000 people lived up there. Hmm. The bog side, I'm sure, was something similar. I don't know what number of people lived down there. And then you had the Brandywell as well. And, you know, so it was a very built up area, a lot of people, high unemployment and that type of thing. But, you know, to me as a boy, it didn't feel depressed or anything.
Yeah.
But every street had a barricade, you know, put across it. And the barricade was made out of rubble taken from the broken pavements.
And to prevent the army getting in then, is that free dairy?
Well, initially to prevent the army or the police from infiltrating the area easily. You had a vigilante hut, which was like your standard workman, a hut that you would see a workman in a building site. And there was a vigilante hut at the end of our street where the men on the street went into that hut at night to keep watch over area at night in case the army try to sort of infiltrate the area. And those barricades were our playground. Yeah. And then, you know, I remember the odd occasion you would see like an army foot patrol coming walking down through the Craigan, and you would think, you know, this is unbelievable, an actual live army. And the guys maybe would be sitting in the grass or kneeling down beside a house or, you know, taking up positions of, you know, being protective or whatever. And you'd see them in their helmets and their flak jackets and their rifles and all that. And to a young boy, it was completely and utterly awesome, like looking at this absolutely. Military figure, you know.
Well, how many children in the world play army men or play this sort of stuff? Whereas you're actually living it, you're in the middle of it, you know.
Exactly, you know. And so I do remember that. Then I remember it gradually escalating and seeing the riots and stuff.
At the time, like I'd imagine, how would you have viewed the IRA at that time? You know, as protectors or as just local lads who get involved in a certain thing, you know, like what how did you see them?
Well, we certainly would have saw them as one of us.
Yeah.
And we would have saw them as protectors and people who were part of our community. And I remember seeing IRA foot patrols, which is another incredible thing. You know, when you think of, say, you know, looking at Palestine or whatever, and you would have seen sort of guys in civilian clothes carrying weapons. And here we were in Derry and the Craigan in Northern Ireland, and you would have seen guys from the estate carrying rifles and stepping out and stopping vehicles and wearing masks. And, you know, I remember watching a guy one time open fire on an army lookout post. You know, I was a safe distance away and I was able to look and I seen this guy with an automatic rifle just shooting, you know, like it's just unreal.
Yeah. And again, at the age you're at, you can look back on it now in a certain way, but at the age you're at, I'd imagine it's just both terrifying and very exciting at the same time.
Aye. And I have to say, it's probably more exciting than it was terrifying. And I'm being honest at that time, you know, I never felt in any danger. I never felt that I was at risk. I just felt that, wow, look at this. You know, there's a guy down there with a gun. And if somebody come up and says, there's an IRA checkpoint down there, everybody would have ran down towards it. It's not like you ran away from it. You ran down towards it.
Well, the documentary that I watched in anticipation of this episode was, you know, Children in Crossfire that you feature in, actually. But what it did say was that a lot of the times the children were kind of sometimes pulled in as to add distraction to allow the free movement of the IRA. I'm just wondering, do you ever remember anything like that happening, or do you think that was just exaggeration on the part of the documentary?
I think it's a complete fabrication, to be honest. You know,
yeah.
Never was I asked or my friends asked to be a decoy or anything.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. In fact, I can remember, you know, being told to get off the streets.
Yeah, it's not safe.
Because there was an incident about to happen. You know, I can remember that all right, you know. But I genuinely, no, I'm not saying it didn't happen in Northern Ireland. But
yeah.
I'm not aware if it did, but certainly it never happened in my experience.
Yeah, we should say, and I will definitely say it in the episode, the documentary itself is fascinating, but it's also a very, very biased documentary. So though it's a great account of events, it's also told from a very, very particular perspective. So
you're right. And that documentary in particular, it's Children in Crossfire, believe it or not. And that was recorded back in 1974. And it did come under a lot of criticism from the local community. I know people weren't pleased by the way it, you know, by the slant that it took, by the way in which the children were kind of set up to look, you know, and it sort of portrayed us all as young terrorists in training, you know, and the making and all of that, and it was anything but.
Well, it's funny though, because it's, I'd imagine, like the media has had a tendency to come in and try and put a slant on, but they've tried to tell the their particular interpretation of the story. You know, like when the rioting happened there recently in March, the international media started getting involved and, you know, they're like, oh, it's back on in Belfast. But like, it's just something very exciting on the outside, but they're coming in with a narrative that doesn't necessarily reflect what's actually happening, I think.
Well, that's right. You know, and if you ask children to go down and riot so that you can film them, then to me, that's not an authentic situation. You know, that's
exactly
staged.
Yeah, you need to actually, it's not real documentary where you're staying with them and seeing just what life is like. Like, you know, one thing I did want to ask you about as well was, did you find that you know where there was a lot of debris along the ground and bullets and that sort of stuff? Did you find yourself collecting that? Was that something that happened? Or again, was that something that was exaggerated?
It was amazing. It was amazing to sort of, like, if you found rubber bullets lying about and stuff like that. Not that you did that often, because people did, you know, snap them up if they were there. And I mean, even during riots, when the army would have fired rubber bullets, people would have been away picking them up. They were like collector's items all the time. So, but you would have come across things like that, rubber bullets particularly, or maybe spent CS gas canisters.
Jeez, and did you have a collection yourself at home?
I had one or two, but you know, they drift on after a while. But yep, I had one or two. And big, I come a big family of 9 brothers and 3 sisters, as I mentioned earlier. And, you know, I was the second youngest, so my brothers used to land home my stuff as well. Yeah. So you did have a collection. Every house had a collection at some stage, I'm sure.
And were your parents, were they ever afraid for you when you'd go out, or were you kind of just, I'm just off with the lads? Or did they, because I think a lot of the sources I've read is just how normalized the Troubles were. After a while, you're like, ah, feck, it's another bomb scare. You know, I won't be able to get to the shop in time. Or it just became just daily life, I guess.
I think there was a kind of an acknowledgement or a sense that, you know, that anything that would happen wouldn't really turn in on us. And, you know, if there was a bomb scare, then, you know, maybe it, especially in our area, then it probably generally would have been safe enough. Now, obviously, that things like that didn't happen, and people were killed by bombs and stuff like that. But generally, there was, you know, if you're aware of a bomb scare, then you would have been, you know, had to vacate the area. And, you know, and the only thing that I think would have worried your parents is when you had the impromptu, say, gun battles and stuff like that, where, you know, maybe the IRA would open fire on the military. And there were, you know, sometimes you knew when that was going to happen because of maybe a buildup of something or other. Like, for example, Poland Day, every election, you know, the school, my old school, was used as a polling booth. Or a polling station.
Yeah.
And when the police or the army would come in to collect, you know, pick up the polling boxes at the end of the day, then it was a time when, you know, the IRA would have maybe planned an attack. So in situations like that, your parents would have been aware that, look,
yes, they knew there were certain days. Tonight. Again, as a child, like, was there ever a fear or a draw of being into paramilitaries on the side of your brothers or sisters or anything?
I think, you know, there was always a potential that people were attracted to paramilitaries, and you know, because there was a bit of a kind of a romance around it in a way.
Yeah,
there was a macho-ness around it, and you know, like, you know, when we would have, even as children, played, you know, in every other part of the world, children would have played cowboys and Indians. We played IRA men and British soldiers. And everybody wanted to be an IRA man. Nobody wanted to be a British soldier.
You get the short end of the straw there.
So that's how we viewed it at that particular point in time, like back in the early 70s.
And do you have any recollections of Bloody Sunday? I know you were quite young. You would have been around 9 at the time, but I guess it was quite a very significant event that happened right around the corner from you, you know?
Yeah, I do remember Bloody Sunday. It's probably one of those days that it was a normal day, and you probably wouldn't remember anything about Bloody Sunday, only as a result of what happened, then every detail almost stays with you. And like, I can remember, it was a Sunday sort of midday-ish, you know, lunchtime-ish, and out playing football in the street and watching all the men and women make their way to Bishop's Field and the Craigan, where the march was kicking off from. I can remember the conversations in our house about who's going to march today and are you going to march today and all that. And, you know, and then I can recall being down at the end of our street, on a street called Broadway, believe it or not. And we were down there, we just moved about at different times. And I can remember watching the people returning home from the march. And I can remember all the serious faces in that. And then I saw one man with tears in his eyes. And I remember thinking that it was probably the CS gas that caused the tears. But subsequently I discovered it was because of what he witnessed. And I heard him saying to somebody, "There's murder down there." And so that was my first knowledge that something had gone south really with that. And then later on that evening, I was on the street with my friends and I saw my Uncle Willie leaving our house. Arriving at our house. My Uncle Willie arriving at the house. And my Uncle Willie lived in Donegal. And it was very unusual for him to come in at that time of the night. Normally, they would come in sort of like a set visit to our house from Donegal. It was a bit of a journey in those days. And, you know, it would have been like, your Uncle Willie's arriving today and, you know, we would all be up to see him and all that sort of stuff. Whereas this was a visit that, you know, he was arriving late at night. And then I saw one of my brother Liam leaving our house. And again, Liam was married and living out of the house at that stage. But, you know, he drove a car. We didn't have a car in the family and my brother Liam had a car. So it was always like he would have been waving at you or winking down the window to talk to you or being sociable. Whereas this particular day, I saw him literally run out of our house and run into a car and he looked very serious. So those things I remember clearly. And then I eventually went home, went into the house. Obviously, it was coming close to bedtime, maybe 7 o'clock or half seven at night or whatever, as a young boy. And I went into the house and my mammy was sitting in our living room and she was crying. And the TV was on, the room was silent. And my mammy said, "Your Uncle Gerard was killed today." And at that stage, you know, you were sitting on the sofa, you saw the news bulletins coming in, telling you that there were 5 people killed, there were 8 people killed at the march in Derry, and our house was completely silent. And I know that some of the boys hadn't returned home, my older brothers, and, you know, my mammy and them were watching the door constantly.
Just terrified.
Until everybody came in. So, and then of course, my Uncle Gerard was shot dead on Bloody Sunday. So I can remember going to the wake and seeing my Aunt Ida, and she was completely distraught.
Ah, the poor thing.
Yeah, and like she was a young mother in her, you know, mid-30s. She had 8 children and was expecting her 9th. And the 9th child was born 3 weeks after Bloody Sunday. And you know, and then I remember one of the starkest memories. Well, God, there's so many, Oisín, you know, like my brother took me for a run in the car down around the bogside the day after Bloody Sunday. And I can remember seeing all the places where people had been shot because there was all these pools of congealed blood. I remember seeing the civil rights banner lying on a pool of blood. Jeez. I can remember going under the Craigan Chapel. And again, it was shocking. You see it, you know, anybody gets into a chapel, you would saw maybe one coffin of somebody who passed away. There were 13 coffins in the chapel lined across the altar. And it was just an unbelievable thing to see 13 coffins all at once in a chapel.
I can't imagine, Richard, like at the age you were as a 9-year-old boy, like that, it's such a sobering event, you know, like I just find it so, you know, as it'd be very difficult to deal with as a grown adult, you know, as a child, I just can't imagine how that would affect you, you know?
You know, sometimes I think, Oisín, you know what happens? Part of you remains a child, but part of you grows up.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I went to my Uncle Gerard's funeral and I saw my Aunt Ida being carried shoulder high away from the cemetery, being distraught. And like, those, the thoughts that you have then are not the thoughts of a child.
Yeah.
What you're seeing there is not something a child should see. And I think, though, there is a part of you that suddenly grows up. And then there's a part of you that'll still be that child that'll go and play a game of football or
the combination of the two. And I guess in a way you can kind of see how something as tragic as that led to that anger and that hate that really turned some people in the direction of paramilitary violence. You know, and quite a significant, Bloody Sunday proved to be quite significant, I think, at that when it came to recruiting.
Exactly right. And I mean, it did. Of course it did. I mean, yeah. I would say the IRA probably couldn't cope with the amount of people that wanted to join at that stage. And, you know, and sometimes I think that that's probably something that's missed in the sort of when we talk about the conflict here, that there are many people who probably joined up in paramilitaries who, in a normal society, would never have joined up in something like that. Who are not naturally violent people, and who probably ended up committing atrocities themselves and hurting other people. And it's very hard for a victim of, say, IRA violence to see an IRA man, let's say, in the light I've just described. And I totally get that completely.
Yeah.
But there is a reality, and the reality is people responded in different ways to situations. And some people decided to respond in a way that meant taking the campaign, the military campaign, to the British.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oof. Sorry, yeah. I can. It's understandable, but it's just so incredibly tragic because it would end up leading to so much. Little did anyone know there was 30 more years of this coming, and each explosion would cause another shockwave and cause another kind of almost another recruitment. But
yeah, that's a tragedy. You know, that's a tragedy of war and violence, and you know, because as much as you can try to understand and rationalize somebody getting caught up in violence and becoming involved, at the end of the day, you know, it's still terrible for the people then who end up at the wrong end of a gun or a bomb.
I've heard you describe this before, Richard, that there are two types of victims. And one victim is, you know, there's one direct victim of an attack who's injured or who's killed, but then there's also the victim is the person who engages in the becomes a paramilitary, because it's a very difficult life to get out of, I think, in some ways, once you get in at a young age.
Yeah, well, I was actually, and when we talked about that, I was quoting another guy that I know in Derry whose father was killed by a loyalist paramilitary group. And, you know, as you know, I have my own podcast, which I know you're going to talk about later. But, I mean, I interviewed this guy for the podcast. And, you know, he is very forgiven and very understanding about what happened to his daddy, you know. Mm. But one of the comments that he said to me that is just what you've said there, that there are two types of victims. There's the direct victims like me, who was blinded by the British Army. There are people like my Uncle Jared, who was murdered by the British Army. And then there are people who react to that and get involved in violence. And, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow. It's a hard concept to take on board if you've been so terribly hurt by someone who's planted a bomb or, you know, deliberately went out to kill your loved one. But it is a reasonable thing, I think, to see perpetrators as victims as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely understand. That does bring me, I guess, maybe we should talk a little bit about what happened to you, which was only a couple of months, I think maybe 3 or 4 months after Bloody Sunday. I think it happened in May, maybe. If you want, if you'd like to maybe explain what happened to you on that fateful day, if you don't mind.
Not at all, Oisin. I mean, I was just 10 years of age. I went to the local primary school It was on the edge of the Craigan estate. It was right beside a police station. And Craigan, as we already talked about, was, you know, a no-go area or barricades. It was, you know, a violent place in many ways. And this police station, because of where it was located, at the edge of a no-go area, was a target for the IRA and that. And then the British Army were brought in to protect this police station. And one of the army lookout posts protecting that police station was faced into the school football pitch. And about 3 months after Bloody Sunday, on the 4th of May, 1972, in fact, it's only next week will be my, I think, 49th anniversary.
Wow.
You know, I was running along the pitch and a British soldier fired a rubber bullet. It hit me in the bridge of the nose. And I lost my right eye and my left eye was permanently blinded. So that's basically what happened that day, you know.
Did you see the soldier or was it just you didn't even see?
No, you couldn't see the army. They were inside these, if you visualize the area, I mean, there was a row of terrace houses that faced out onto the road. But the back of those houses backed onto the school football pitch.
Okay.
But there was a gap in between the houses that would have let you through to the police station. And so the military filled that gap with an army lookout post that went from wall to wall. And you couldn't see into it. The army looked out through a kind of a porthole, you might say. But this hut was built to protect the soldiers against bombs and bullets. So it was had barbed wire in front of it.
Very fortified.
Iron. Yeah, very fortified. That's actually the best way to describe it. And so you couldn't see into it at all. And so we used to shout at it, things like that, as kids would do, you know. And but you never knew even if there were anybody in there because they didn't even react. It's not like even shouted back out at you or anything.
Yeah.
The military didn't even react. So it was from inside that the soldier fired the rubber bullet. So no, I never saw.
And then, yeah, I guess, like, I'd imagine it was a very shocking event for you, or it's you didn't really know. Again, you're so young at the time. But did you know straight away that your sight was just gone, or were you just, you know, did you get home, or?
Oh, no, it wasn't even like, I mean, I was seriously injured at the time. So I can remember I woke up and I was lying on the school canteen table where my music teacher, Mr. Giles Doherty, he heard the bang and he ran over and lifted me, found me lying on the ground and he carried me over and put me on the school canteen table. And I remember him saying to me, "What's your name, son?" And I told him my name was Richard Moore. And he got a bit of a shock because he knew me very well. I was in his music class, but because of the extent of the injuries, my nose was completely flattened. My eyeballs were down at my cheekbones.
Jesus.
And my face was just a bloody mess. So when I went to hospital, initially they thought I was going to die from the injuries. Then they thought I was going to have brain damage. And then finally, they told my parents that I would be blind for the rest of my life. So it was a pretty serious injury. Like it was touch and go for about a week whether I would live or not, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And did the army make any response? I know later on, kind of, there was the courts or litigation or whatever, but at the time, did they respond in any way or was...
Well, the army would have, the army basically, this, you know, took the stance that I was a young hoodlum.
Okay.
They described me as a think. They said I was a rioter and more or less said that what happened, I brought on to myself. Now, the reality is I wasn't a rioter. I was on a school playground. There was no pedestrian pass through there. It was a playground that was surrounded by the school and backed these houses backed onto it. There was no pedestrians walked through there. There was no public access other than children and the teachers. So like they suggest that there was a riot. It's just bizarre because, you know, the teachers knew there was an army lookout post faced on the school playground. So yeah, they knew they keep a vigilance around that area when the children were going home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make sure that nothing silly happened. So we would have been shooed along in that. And it didn't mean we didn't shout at the army or whatever. You know, yeah, of course we did hopefully get away with it before the teacher would catch you shouting.
Yeah,
journey.
It's not kind of the thuggery sort of rioter that they were trying to convey. Yeah.
And I was probably the oldest there. I was 10 years of age. Now, there was an older school there that got out after ours, but I was probably the oldest there. So, but listen, that's what the military did in those days, you know, get first strike, you know, blame the victim and take it from there. And, you know, and then that position never really changed right down through the years, you know, that's the stance they had.
Well, it was kind of, I guess it was kind of interesting that you mentioned earlier that the IRA would do foot patrols, because in a way it was guerrilla warfare. So the British Army didn't know what was coming at them and what direction it was coming. So as a result, they just took a very aggressive stance and that's what I guess led to a lot of the injuries and the killings that happened, because it was when they were indiscriminate. Am I making sense there? Does that sound a bit mad?
I think there's a lot of questions need to be asked. I believe the rubber bullet was fired that day carelessly. I think it was unlawful. I think it was irresponsible. And, you know, I think it was, you know, something that just shouldn't have happened. Now, you know, what leads somebody to think that it's all right to do that? I think the British soldier is responsible for firing the rubber bullet.
Yeah.
But I also think that there's a wider responsibility. And, you know, when you have a society and a culture behind those soldiers, tell them that whatever you do is fine.
Yeah.
Whatever you do is okay. Then, you know, you have to question what leads a person to think that it's all right to do that. What leads a highly trained, fully disciplined British soldier to fire a rubber bullet into a school playground at a group of children and think that it's all right?
Think that they're doing it justified. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, so that I think we have to question, obviously, the soldier, but you need to question the society that supports that activity.
Yeah, that was making the calls.
And gives that license to behave in the way they behave.
But, well, look, we'll move a little bit on beyond that. But did you adjust to being blind? It seems like you did very well from what I've heard in the past. But was it a difficult adjustment for you at the start?
Well, yes, I did adjust to being blind, and I bounced back very quickly to blindness. And, you know, and have continued to be, you know, almost see blindness in a positive light and not always entirely in a negative light. Did I adjust quickly? I think I did adjust reasonably quickly, but there were challenges. And at the time, like, you know, I always think there's two sides to blindness. There's the emotional side, and there's a physical side. So the physical side was being able to move about freely and all that. And, you know, thanks to my friends, to the local community, to my family, then, you know, they were really supportive. And, you know, there was always somebody about to guide me around, and they include me in things and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you used to go cycling, didn't you?
I used to go on a bicycle, and my friends used to run in front of me shouting directions. You can imagine how that went after a while. They were exhausted.
I can't imagine that ended well, but who knows?
it ended all right. But I mean, that, you know, the problem was that, you know, I was cycling at a certain speed, and they were trying to run ahead of me, and it became pretty exhausting. But I mean, you know, I did try to mix in the best I could. So there's that physical side of it, and then there's the emotional side of it. And, you know, there were times that I missed not being able to play football the way I used to play football. And I would always say about blindness, like, you know, at that time in the initial days, it has its adjustments. But blindness always has its adjustments. It's not like all of a sudden after the first 6 months or a year, that's that I have it conquered. You know, that's that, you know, park that. It's not. There's always something that challenges you emotionally.
Yeah. You know, emotionally or physically? So say if you move to a new space,
both,
or is it
both?
Yeah.
You know, both. It depends on what you're talking about. Like, for example, when I was 17 and my friends were learning to drive, and, you know, and had cars, or remember one night a mate of mine arrived on a motorbike, you know, and you're going, you know, like, physically I can't go on,
yeah,
know, drive a motorbike. I can't go out and drive my own car. And so there's those physical sides to what you're doing, even how you dress, you know, like as you're growing up as a 14 or 15 year old, and you want to make sure that you fit in. You want to make sure you're wearing the right clothes, and you know, and all that sort of stuff. And
so, how did you conquer that then? Was that
my sister bought clothes for me and all that, but I never felt totally comfortable with my sister buying me clothes because I thought they were maybe making me dress more feminine or something. They probably weren't, but that's what I was always worried about.
Unless you ticked them off, you wouldn't want to. You want to stay on their good side, I'd imagine.
Well, what I done then is I decided to get into a particular band, which in those days, the Bay City Rollers were the top band of the era. And they had this tartan gear that everybody wore. And I decided I would go for that. And I think that was my way of entering into an area that was safe, that, you know, that basically it was popular clothes, a popular band sort of pushed out. And if I dressed like that, then I was looking reasonably trendy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. At that age, you just kind of want to be part. Like, I did it with heavy metal. So I had Metallica and Slipknot and all these bands.
Well, there you are. You see,
it's exactly the same.
And you know, you fit in. And this is my way of doing it, I think. And then the emotional side of it is, you know, there's just times that you feel sad about certain things you can't do. You know, and, you know, as life goes on, you know, like you just, you know, there will be, and I've accepted there will always be times in my life when something will click in that will really make you feel sad about being blind. Like, for example, I have two daughters. And when both of my daughters were born, you know, I would have given anything to see them.
Yeah.
And I would still give anything to see my two daughters. Like, my youngest daughter got married 3 years ago, and I obviously gave her away, as all daddies do, you know, in terms of their daughters. And, you know, I can remember standing just before we went up the aisle, in a sense, and, you know, just thinking, God, you know, I would just love to see her, you know. But, you know, I've accepted the fact that that happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's other things like, you know, my daddy's passed away now, my mommy's passed away. And, you know, photographs are very important for my family, you know, and they would get out photographs now and again. They would look at, you know, that's Mullen Gardens. That's my mommy out hanging up the wash, and that's your daddy out kicking a football or whatever it might be. And I can't see those photographs.
Yeah.
So the only photographs I have are what's in my memory. And, you know, there's times that I would like to have that physical thing.
Do you have any audio of your parents?
None. Yes, my mommy, I do. I have none of my daddy. My daddy died when I was 17, and those are just, wasn't organized. Maybe recordings weren't a thing in those days either. But I have recordings of my mommy singing and stuff, and the guitar and her singing and stuff, so, which is brilliant. And that is brilliant, and because they are my photographs in a sense.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's always going to be that emotional side of blindness that thank God, Oisin, it's momentary.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking to you about it now. As I'm talking to you, I feel a lump in my throat. And, you know, there's times the lump takes over and, you know, you get a bit weepy. But, you know, 5 minutes after, 2 minutes after, you know, it's gone.
I think you're so exceptional is because you, and I wonder, is this related to it in a way, but you never seem to have possessed any hate whatsoever. And you've never seemed to gone in any direction that that would be, you know, for you, you've almost gone straight down the path of forgiveness. And it's and you've kept that your entire life, where you've just wanted to help others and forgive and approach things in a completely non-violent way. And I just wonder, you know, were you ever tempted, or was it straight away you believed in this? I'm making a mess of phrasing this, I think. But, you know, how did you turn away from hate, I guess?
Yeah. I don't know, Oisin. I mean, I don't remember having any hatred whatsoever. And, you know, if I had met a British soldier in the street, I would have been friendly with him. And I think that it had to do with my parents, because I know that they never spoke in an angry way about what happened. And in fact, they would have said the opposite. My parents were two very devout Catholics, actually. You know, they went to Mass every day of their lives. They were just so loving and caring, and they had an enormous faith. And, you know, my mommy prayed all the time. My daddy prayed all the time. And, you know, but they didn't bit it in the ear. They weren't Bible punchers in the house or not. But they used to sort of say, look, you know, it's important that you say your prayers. It's important that you go to Mass. It's important that you keep God in your life, type of thing. And that was that, really. Their witness was just how they lived their life, really. Lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, now they were brokenhearted with what happened to me. I mean, my mommy basically had a mental breakdown after I was shot, though I was never diagnosed. But the more I talk about it and the more I'm aware of it, then I realize my mommy basically, you know, the woman was found walking down through a main street in Derry in the middle of the road, talking to herself.
She
used to go and sit in the chapel for hours on end, crying and crying. She contemplated suicide. You know, my mom had all those experiences. And I can remember at night, lying in my bed, and my mommy would come up and she would kneel beside my bed, and she thought I was sleeping. And she would start to say her prayers. And then she would break down and she would start to cry. And she'd be saying things like, God, look at him. He's only a 10-year-old boy. Please give him back his eyesight. And she wouldn't be saying it in the way that I'm saying it now. She was just desperate. So, and my daddy, he was, you know, he was a remarkably strong man, you know. And my daddy, for you know, being an unemployed shoemaker, he was really such an intelligent man and such a practical man. But, you know, when he came back from the hospital, after they told him that I would be blind for the rest of my life, he just stood in the middle of our street and cried with the man out of the street. You know, and I was told long after that my daddy had died, and long after the incident, you know, I wrote an autobiography. And as part of the autobiography, I started to research things and ask questions around the family members and stuff about, because there are a lot of what happened around that time that I wouldn't even be aware of because I was in the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
You know, and when my daddy was in the hospital, the doctors told him that Richard's not going to get his eyesight back, Mr. Murr, or whatever. And my daddy said, can I give him my eyes? And I just think that that's one of the most incredibly caring and loving and compassionate thing that anybody could ever do. All he could give was his own eyesight.
That's beautiful. That's really, really nice.
It's amazing. But they had all that hurt, all that pain, but no anger. You know?
Yeah.
Like, and that's the reality.
Yeah, well, because it could have gone a different way. You know, if that household had all that hate, you know, you would have grown up kind of hating this other side, which it seems quite the opposite. You grow up understanding in a way.
It's so easy, Oisin, because, you know, and that's one of the lessons in life for me. And I take a lot of lessons out of my story. There's a lack of anger and a and the presence of forgiveness and how important it is. But, you know, as well as that, what I've learned is how important you and me are in the lives of other people and what we say and what we influence can either point people in the right direction or the wrong direction. So quite often you would hear me saying, like, you know, whether you be a father or a mother, whether you be a brother or sister, whether you be a politician, whether you be a leader of some description, what you say is very important. And you've got to take responsibility for what you say.
Yeah.
And, you know, if my mommy and daddy had been sitting in our living room going, I'll not be happy to every British soldier's locked up in jail. I never forgive these guys. And, you know, I hate them, and I hate them until until the end of my days. And, you know, that soldier that blinded you, Richard, I'll not be happy until he's in jail and the key's thrown away. And what do you think I would have been thinking?
Yeah.
I would have been thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Whereas my mom, I remember one of my brothers in the kitchen. Now, our house was a small house in the Craig in Oisin. And, you know, so when you're sitting in one room, you could hear what's going on in the other room. I mean, mommy spent her whole day in the kitchen washing and cooking and ironing and cleaning and all the stuff. Like, that's just her life was in the kitchen. And I remember my brother was, and it wasn't very long after I was shot, you know, but I was out at home. And my brother was out with my mommy in the kitchen. And he was shouting at her. And he was angry. And he was saying things like, you know, they murdered my Uncle Jared. They blinded Richard. It's time to give her own back. And I remember my mommy saying, if you want to help Richard, go on there and help Richard. But you're not helping Richard by hurting somebody else. So that was the message. And, you know, when I think of my mommy saying that, how incredible is that? In the middle of her own hurt and pain and mental anguish, she was able to say, you're wrong. The way you're thinking is wrong.
So it's very brave.
It's incredible.
It really is. Yeah, absolutely.
So if I have notions of forgiveness, then that's where it comes from. It comes from her.
Yeah. Your mother sounds like an absolute hero. That's really beautiful, honestly. Really, really lovely.
No, I know, and it's nice for me to have those thoughts too, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I owe so much to the both of them for the example that they set for me in my life, you know.
Yeah.
And all of that contributes towards my ability to accept blindness, my ability to move on in my life.
Well, you've never, you don't use a cane, do you?
I don't use a white stick or a guide dog. And it's funny, you know, you wonder why that is. And this is where I think sometimes the point I made earlier, where you kind of grow up in one part of your brain and the other part of your brain still remains a child. I wouldn't carry a white stick because I don't want people to see me as a blind person. Now, where does a 10 or 11-year-old get that from?
Yeah.
It's such a, you know, an adult way to think.
Yeah.
I don't want people to see me as a blind person. So instead, I used to go around the street using the end of a fishing rod.
Okay.
He's
not blind. He's just going fishing, I swear.
He's not blind. He's just got off his head and got around with a fishing rod.
Yeah, if you don't want me to ask, like, getting around now, then, do you, without using the cane or the dog, is it more difficult to use your hands? Or
in terms of being in the house and in the office, stuff like that, you know, as most blind people will tell you, when you're in your own environment, you're as familiar with it as anybody with sight is, so you can walk around without any real need, any assistance whatsoever. Where it becomes a challenge is when you go into an environment, or the guy can't get up and literally say, I'm going to walk down to the shop or down into the city centre where I am at the minimum, say 6 or 7 minutes walk from the city centre in Derry. I can't just get up and do that.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, if I had a white stick or I had a guide dog, I could do that. You know, if if trained properly. But I've never felt the need to have that level of independence. So if I can't go to the shop now, then I won't go to the shop. So, but I, so I've lived my life through taxis, buses, trains, planes, and automobiles. And then obviously friends guide me about in that. Now, it's always right for me to acknowledge the fact that not everybody has that level of support.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they do need their training. And I wouldn't rule it out for me in the future. But at the minute, I don't need it because I'm content with the limitations that blindness puts on me.
Yeah.
And, you know, but also I have enough people around me that you know, if I need to go anywhere, I need to do anything.
Yeah, the support structure is there.
The support's there, like on an hourly basis almost. But, and, you know, again, that's another interesting thing about blindness, Aisín, you know, and one of the reasons why maybe I've accepted blindness is you have to accept the limitation of blindness. Like, as much as I lead a normal life, my life isn't as independent as yours would be.
Yeah.
You know, you could say now, right, I'm going to go to the Chippy, or I'm going to go to McDonald's, I'm going to go up the town to do a bit of shopping, I'm going to get out and go for a walk, and you just go out, hop in the car, drive up under the hills, go for a walk, drive into the city centre, go to McDonald's, whatever it is you want to do, and you can do it all without a thought.
You need to prepare or
plan. I can't do that.
Yeah.
I simply can't do that. Now, is that important to me? And the reality is, it's not. And what I've learned is that if I keep focusing on the things that I can't do, then I'm going to be a very unhappy person.
Yeah.
And you know, if you think about it, there's probably things you can't do. There's probably things you can do, but you couldn't be bothered doing. So you can build these things up in your head to become.
Yeah.
I've accepted the fact I can't jump out on there, grab the keys of the car, and drive off. If I'm going to constantly yearn for that, then I am going to be a very unhappy person. So
it's focusing on your limitations versus focusing on your abilities.
And it's focusing on what you can do, not what you can't do.
Yeah.
And I don't know what percentage. At times, 100% of my life, I'm able to do exactly what I want to do. There's times that only 40% or 30% of my life, I can only do what I want to do. So it depends what it is.
Yeah.
It depends when you're doing it and all of that. But it's just learning to accept the fact, right, I can't do that. So I can't drive a car.
Yeah. Why focus on that?
My sister-in-law doesn't drive a car. You know, my sister-in-law never learned to drive. So that's my phone talking. My sister-in-law never learned to drive. So, like, you know, the difference between me and her is she has a choice. I don't. But the end result's the same. Am I going to allow that to dominate my life? You know, that I can't physically drive a car.
Yeah.
You know, as an example.
Makes perfect sense. You focus on that which is within your means. And
exactly.
Again, for you, there's been a lot, like, as in, just to kind of move on a little bit. So as you grew up, you bought two pubs, was it?
Yeah, I bought two pubs in the center of Derry.
So you were able to kind of run a successful business, and that kind of would have been a perfectly adequate livelihood for you, but you kind of wanted to take your life in a different way with the starting up of a charity.
That's right. I was compensated for being shot, and part of some of the money I went into business. And when I came out of university, I went straight into running my own business. But, you know, all during that time, one, I didn't feel totally satisfied. You know, it wasn't really a job that I felt this is really what I want to do. And, you know, the second thing was that I spent most of my self-employed life trying to fundraise for charities and stuff like that. So, and I felt myself being motivated. I felt myself being motivated to help children who suffered from poverty. You know, I used to take part in the Great Famine Walks in Dublin, or in Mayo, down in Lewisburg. There was a charity in Dublin called AFRI, and that was a Derry guy, Don Mullen, was involved with AFRI in those days. And there was another guy called Joe Murray, and they used to sort of run these great famine walks in the south of Ireland. They raise awareness, obviously they in some way remember the victims of the famine, but also they use it as a way to lobby for young people affected by, or not young people, people affected by poverty in other parts of the world. And I used to go to these things, and I used to be totally enthralled by it and inspired by it. So I decided to sell out the business and set up Children in Crossfire. Why did I do that? I did it because I realized that I could be a voice for children that can't speak for themselves. I realized that despite what happened to me, I still was able to go back to school and get an education for myself. I had loads of support from family and community. And I was on the receiving end of so much kindness and generosity. And I just thought, if I could give some of that back, then, and I was able to help one child, then my blindness was worthwhile. And, you know, I set up Children in Crossfire in 96, and Children in Crossfire is now going 25 years. I'm talking to you from the Children in Crossfire office here. And we're going 25 years now. And over those 25 years, you know, we've impacted on the lives of millions of children throughout the world.
And is it specifically, Richard, can I ask, is it for children in war situations, or is it
not at all? No. I suppose I picked the term Children in Crossfire because of my own story.
Yeah.
But also because children throughout the world are caught in the crossfire of poverty. They're caught in the crossfire of global decisions that they can do nothing about. They can't change. They didn't create, but they are suffering the consequences. So sometimes children don't have bombs or bullets flying over their heads, but they are suffering all the same.
But starvation or malaria or something, you know.
Yeah. So children caught in a crossfire of poverty. And, you know, and they are victims of today's world as much as a child is a victim of war. And, you know, and I just think, like, every child deserves a chance to grow and blossom. Every child deserves a chance to be happy, to have a home life, to be healthy. And, you know, do you not think it's a dreadful affront of modern society that children are actually dying as we speak from not having a drink of clean water, from not having access to food? How can that be allowed to happen in a world that's so well developed?
That we call a modern society.
It's unbelievable. And I always say this, Oisin, children are dying not because there isn't enough food or resources in the world. It's because there isn't enough will in the world.
Because that's a good point. Yeah.
People need to prioritize. We have no difficulty investing money and developing bombs, buying weapons, building weapons. You know, the military machine in the world, to keep it going, costs, you know, hundreds of billions of pounds to keep going. And we can't seem to find the money to once and for all improve the lives of children that suffer from poverty. And the sad thing about it, I've been out there. I've been in the villages. I've held the hands of children, young children. I've met their parents who are looking at you the way my mommy and daddy looked at the doctor in Anthony Galvin Hospital. And we're just pleading with a result. Just pleading for a result. Pleading that somebody somewhere can help their child. And, you know, it's just sad to think that not every child is reached. And, you know, Children in Crossfire, we work in Tanzania and Ethiopia now. I'm delighted to say that we're supported by the Irish government significantly.
Yeah,
and I just be delighted by Irish Aid in terms of their genuine desire to continue supporting people even during difficult times.
Yeah.
The Irish government has managed to continue to send resources out to.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know the Irish government were helping out. That's absolutely
brilliant. Yeah, and, you know, we've the British government as well. And, you know, but at the end of the day, if there's a child alive in Tanzania or Ethiopia or getting education in Tanzania and Ethiopia or receiving some kind of resources, it's not because of me. It's not even because of Children in Crossfire. It's because of those people in my life that showed me what real love and compassion is. Because all I ever wanted to do was give back some of what they taught me.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know where to go from that. Jeez. Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, yeah, I was about to say you should be a motivational speaker, but I feel like that's one of the monikers you you already have. So I think.
Well, I'm a speaker. I don't know if I've been motivational.
I think so. I think so.
I hope
definitely,
so.
Definitely, you'll inspire me to go and do something today anyway, whatever it may be. But okay, I've just a couple more I want to get through, Richard. Yeah, and then it will, as it turns out, you actually met the soldier who blinded you. And I think it was maybe about 20 years ago, maybe, or was it?
2005.
And how did that come about? Or was it just, were you trying to find him or did he seek you out? Or
Well, you know, throughout my sort of, I suppose, you know, when I was a young adult, actually, you know, it was mid-20s, I began to, up to then, I really didn't think about blindness, didn't really think about how I coped or anything like that. I just got on with life, played in bands, had a recording studio, loved football, followed football, you know, hanging around with the guys, you know, done everything that a young teenager or young adult would do. And I began to think about, why am I so happy? Why am I so content and all that? So we've covered a lot of that already in this conversation. But I began to become curious. I began to become curious about the man that blinded me. You know, and when you think about my incident, Ashi, at the end of the day, when you peel everything back, there's two people involved, and that's me and the soldier. The most significant thing that happened to me in my life was being shot and blinded. The person I am, the personality I have, the way my life has evolved, was all dictated by that incident that day. I always say when I was knocked over by the rubber bullet, I was knocked on a journey. And the other person that was involved in that experience was a soldier. So I often wondered about him. And at times it was like looking into a shadow. You know, he knew there was somebody there, but you didn't know anything about them.
Yeah.
So I built up this image over the years that the soldier was 18 years of age. He was on an army lookout post on the edge of a no-go area. He was probably crapping himself, you know, frightened, you know, dangerous area to be in. But I always said to some people, and I had no anger as you read this, because so I wanted to meet the guy. I wanted to meet him. I wanted to meet him out of curiosity. And I also wanted to meet him to let him know that I forgive him. And I said it many occasions. I would have done chats like this, I would have been in the newspapers or TV or whatever, and I would have always said, I'd love to meet the soldier someday. But to be honest with you, I thought I would never meet him.
Yeah.
Because it was too sort of closed down.
Yeah, and the British Army are quite secretive as well. It's sometimes
exactly. It's security issues and all that. But eventually, this crowd in Belfast were making a documentary about my story. But they were making it for the BBC. It was called Blind Vision. And we were in a peace process. Things began to relax. And they were able to track down the soldier. So ultimately, I wrote a letter to the soldier. I didn't know his name at that stage. And they hand-delivered it to him. And 3 weeks later, the soldier responded to my letter. And then in my letter, I asked him, would he be willing to meet? And when he responded, he said he would. So then we arranged to meet in Scotland. And it was fantastic. It was an amazing experience, you know.
He was the age of 30 when the shooting happened and stuff. So he was older than I think probably what you'd imagined, was it?
Exactly right. And that was one of the big major adjustments for me. When I received the letter from him and I realized that he was in his 30s when he shot me. He was a captain in the army. And so that whole image that I had for 33 years was turned on its head. And that did take a bit of mental adjustment for me because I did get a bit of a shock in that one.
Yeah, well, you'd kind of, not necessarily excuse it, but you'd said, oh, he was a young, untrained, inexperienced, but instead he was actually well-trained,
And that did, you know, you're right. And, you know, I did in some way excuse the actions of a soldier because I felt the guy that fired the bullet was barely a child himself. Mm. And then to discover that he was a full-blown adult, fully trained, captain in the army, probably shouldn't have been firing rubber bullets, wasn't his job. So it sort of gave me a different slant on it. But, you know, I got over that after a 24-hour period. I processed it and, you know, I cried about it. I thought about it. And, you know, I eventually still wanted to meet him. So, you know, we met in a hotel foyer in Scotland and it was an amazing day. It really was. And I suppose I would say that I learned two things about forgiveness that day. The first thing is, forgiveness is a gift that you give to yourself. And what I mean by that is, you know, that, you know, forget about charge, forget about anything else. Forgiveness is about you and about you fighting freedom, about you releasing yourself to be happy. And then the second thing is, forgiveness doesn't change the past, but it does change the future. And again, I reflect on that quite often, and I try to say to people, look, the fact that I forgive Charles isn't going to give me eyesight back. Isn't going to take away the hurts that were caused. But what forgiveness does do and has done is change your future and, you know, helps you to move on. Yeah. And, you know, all of that stuff to me was incredible. And it's just to get to know him and get to chat with him, you know, and you know, it wasn't the soldier anymore. And the thing, you know, becomes a human being. He's a father.
He's not just the blank space you're looking into in the fortified barracks that you don't know if someone's there or not. This is an actual person who we should say his name is Charles.
Charles Innes, yeah.
But like he had a child the same age as you. You know, he obviously didn't set out to shoot you that day.
I think that Charles, I asked Charles that he deliberately aimed the bullet at me. And he said, no. He said, Richard, I didn't even see you.
Yeah.
So, in his view, rubber bullets didn't cause any damage. Now, you know and I know that that's not true. And I often wonder how Charles would even think that. But the bottom line is, that's what he says. And, you know, I either accept it or I don't. And, you know, but he fired. There's nothing in his terms of engagement that permit what Charles did that day.
Absolutely. There's nothing that says a 10-year-old child.
It's okay to fire rubber bullets randomly. That if you don't even see somebody, that just fired anyway.
And did he apologize?
You know, that's interesting. For 6 years that I knew Charles, if you had asked him, and I mean, me and him are good friends and remain good friends and still good friends. But have you asked them during that first 6 years, do you apologize? Or did you say sorry? You'd have said, no, I didn't say sorry, nor do I feel I need to apologize. But do you know what? I always knew he was sorry. He just couldn't bring himself to say it for some stupid reason, I think. Some misguided reason, let's say.
It might be an admission. Sometimes exactly. that could be, well, we never know. We'll never know what's inside his head, but.
But eventually, 6 years after, we were on Derry here together, and we're over in a local hotel, and we're chatting, and the sorry question come up, and I said to him, well, Charles, the event we're doing the next day, I said, Charles, you're probably going to be asked the sorry questions tomorrow.
You probably get it a lot.
And he said, Richard, I am sorry. And I thought, wow, you know, because I wasn't expecting it. I never asked him. Sorry was not a condition of my meeting with him.
Yeah, it wasn't a conditional forgiveness that you were providing. It was an absolute forgiveness.
Yeah. And as a result of that, then, when he said it, I nearly fell off a chair. It was overwhelming because I never asked for it. And I still got it. So what did that tell me? And again, I'm always looking for lessons. And the lesson it taught me is, you know, maybe I was 100 miles down the road in my journey ahead of Charles. And he had to make his journey too. And many people said to me, you know, I wouldn't have met him until he apologized. If I had operated under that sort of those conditions, then Charles would have never made that journey.
No, he would have never, it would have just been the same. You would have never met each other.
Yeah, and he would have never have said sorry. So in my reckoning, you know, you should never set preconditions to reconciliation. Because, you know, if you genuinely want to reconcile with somebody, you've got to allow them to be who they are. And they've got to allow you to be who you are. They've got to live in their space, and you've got to live in your space. You don't have to agree as long as you facilitate that.
Yeah,
and in doing that...
As long as there's understanding.
Yeah, and in doing that, what's happening? You're freeing up each other. They begin a dialogue and just let's see where that goes, you know? And that's what happened to me.
I'd imagine those 6 years in the making, that was some burden off his shoulders. Even if it's three simple words or whatever, I'd say that's some weight that he'd been carrying around for all those years. And, you know, just to finally say it and to put it out in the open, I think is a very important, what was very important, I guess, you know?
I guess it was, and you know, it's a freedom for him too. You know, he's getting no younger, like all of us. And I just think that, you know, there's some kind of peace in that, you know, some sort of putting things to bed. And, you know, the older you get, Ashley, I don't know what age you are, but...
30 years
old. You're 30. Well, you're a young man. And the older you get, you know, the more you realize that, you know, that life goes through very quickly, and you know, and I would like to think that if I hurt somebody, that I could apologize. I would like to think if I hurt somebody, that they could forgive me, because ultimately, what's it all about? You know, what's life about? You know, we do sometimes hurt somebody, we do sometimes do something, and you know, sometimes good people do bad things. And it doesn't make them bad people. It just means they've done something bad. And I would like to think that if I'd done something bad, that somebody could see the goodness in me and try to move beyond it and allow me that mistake, that disaster, that deliberate wrong action, whatever it is, that somebody can see that was a bad thing, but that's a good person.
Yeah. You know? No, absolutely brilliant advice. Stuff I might have to take home as well, you know?
Well, if it helps, it's good.
So the past few years of your life, Richard, have just been, I'd imagine, a whirlwind. You know, you've met the Dalai Lama a couple of times. You've done a lot of other things. You own a radio station. You are a musician. You are still traveling back and forth to Africa, I'd imagine. So I don't know how you have time to do anything. Tell me a little bit about the podcast that you've started.
Hi. During lockdown, well, as you know, I'm very interested in radio. I have a radio station and a not-for-profit radio station here in Derry called Drive 105. And I really enjoy running that and being involved in part of that. I'm a musician and I had a recording studio. So recording, editing, radio, conversation, all those things are kind of interests of mine. So during the lockdown, when my traveling was significantly hampered and I was at home and all that sort of stuff, I always had this desire to, you know, do a podcast. And so I thought, what type of podcast would I like to do? And I thought, you know what? I would just like to do a podcast that let people tell their story, not unlike what you're doing here, Oisin, probably very similar, you know, but I just wanted to do something because me being able to tell my story has been so, you know, enriching, so healing over my whole life. And I thought, I'm just going to let people tell their story. Plus the fact, through my work, through the travels that I've made, I've met so many people.
Yeah.
And I thought, I may as well use it as an opportunity to get stories. So I come up with a name for a podcast called What About You? Well, I don't know if you know anybody from Derry.
Yeah, it's a Derry slang, isn't it?
Normally it'd say, what about you? Which meant, how are you doing? So yeah. I thought, I'm not going to call it What About You? But I'll call it What About You. Yeah. So I'll be a lot more proper about it. So I call it What About You? And really it's just about people being able to tell and share their story if they're willing to do it. The first series of the podcast, I've recorded about, you know, 13 or 14 now, but there's 10 uploaded and it's all of them are about the conflict. So people affected by the conflict. The next series, I'll move to something completely different, probably away from the conflict.
But I haven't listened to it yet, but the most recent one released as of recording was with Stephen Travers of the Miami Show Band. So that's an episode we covered back at the very start of the podcast. So,
oh, did you? Brilliant. Yeah, well, Steve's a great fella.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to have a word with him someday. So hopefully sometime soon.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure he's maybe more than one to chat. He's a very approachable guy. But God, you know, I am getting, if not more out of it, certainly as much out of it as hopefully the participants are.
I think it's a wonderful idea. Just let people talk. Just let people talk about their time. You know, because again, what I find very interesting with the Troubles is that I'm getting a lot of younger listeners that I really didn't expect, and it's just people who haven't really heard the stories because people have been. It's still so raw that people don't really want to talk about it yet. And I think these are important times and these are important even just pieces of history to capture as well.
That's amazing. Yeah. And it is true. And you know, people out there are struggling in many ways with different things in their life. So like, why do I share my story? Why am I sitting here chatting to you today and recording this? And you know, the reason why I do it is because I realize that there are people out there who might benefit in some way. But I might help them with some issue they have in their life. And, you know, so I think storytelling, I think sharing knowledge, information, experiences is just so enriching for the listener. And, you know, I love meeting people. I love chatting with people. So that's where I got the idea from, really.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful hearing your story today, Richard. And just thank you so much for coming on. And I really hope everyone enjoys this conversation as much as I did.
Thank you. Well, it's great talking to you, Oisin. It's been really enjoyable. Thank you.
Cheers.